Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'm going to examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and look into whether the grand bargain that the White House and the Republican Congress are working on to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff will end up as the Great Betrayal. William K. Black, professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, joins us to discuss the need for the president not to cave into Republican blackmail as he did last time and to fight to preserve Social Security and Medicare. Then we will speak with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, about the extent to which the president has drunk the deficit Kool-Aid, which billionaires like Pete Peterson have been ladling out for decades. We will discuss the deficit hoax and the need for further stimulus instead of the austerity that is crippling Europe. Then finally, Gar Alperovitz joins us. He is an historian, political economist, activist, and writer who believes that bottom-up solutions to empower Americans at the local level are possible as community banks and municipal utilities are beginning to grow as alternatives to the top-down Wall Street financialization of our economy. His forthcoming book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. And joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loans disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And you've been writing fairly regularly in the Huffington Post recently, Bill, warning about the grand bargain underway between President Obama and John Boehner and Cantor and the House. And, I mean, I think one of the things that I find as a disconnect here is that it seems that we have a blue country following the recent election, but we have a purple president. And both Obama and Clinton before him, in many ways, I think their political outlook was shaped by Ronald Reagan in terms of recognizing the politics and power of conservatism in this country. But the most recent election really indicated the end of Ronald Reagan and the end of the conservative majority. So is that a problem here, that our leaders are governing in an America that is largely, you know, passing us by?
No, there's an important part of America, of course, that still has tremendous power, and that is Wall Street. And that's why I and my colleagues at University of Missouri, Kansas City, Econ Department, in our blog, New Economic Perspectives, have been warning for some time about what we call the Great Betrayal that's coming, very much in the interests of Wall Street. You're quite right that President Clinton, long before he was president, believed that he had learned the lessons of President Reagan's success. And the lesson was we had to be more like the Republicans on national security, and in particular on social programs and budgets and such. And so the Democratic Leadership Coalition was explicitly designed, mostly run by Southern and border state Democrats, to push the party very much to the right and to align it, when possible, with the interests of Wall Street, which was seen as being the biggest and the most powerful portion of the economy and the biggest source of finance, contributions, and such. So you're right, Clinton moved that way. Clinton has proclaimed it a brilliant success, his terms, of course, and a young senator looking for a role model in terms of the way up, very much modeled himself on Clinton's. Of course, the irony is he ended up running against Hillary for the presidential nomination, succeeded in large part because he overwhelmingly got the contributions of Wall Street. And when he got in office, of course, inherited a disaster from George Bush, and that was the Great Recession. And he responded to it like a good Reaganite Republican, and to some extent, which is first you do stimulus, and people forget that Reagan did a lot of stimulus, but then you worry enormously about budget deficits, and you swing quickly to an austerity program. And that's what President Obama attempted to do in July of 2011, reached an agreement in principle with the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, a conservative but not Tea Party type Republican. And the deal, the Great Betrayal, or what they called the Grand Bargain, had these components. It was going to make very large cuts in social programs. It was going to make strong cuts in the safety net. So those are things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, those types of things. And it was going to make minor increases in taxation, or really tax revenues, from, to some extent, wealthier Americans, mostly by closing loopholes. That was the centerpiece of the deal. Now, that was significantly insane as a policy matter, because when you adopt austerity in the context of a weak recovery from a great recession, you throw the nation back into recession. Unemployment rises substantially. Your budget deficit grows enormously because you lose tax revenues and increase expenses to try to deal with the increased unemployment and poverty. And, of course, all of this would be far more brutal on the people affected, because you would be eroding the safety net simultaneously and the government programs designed to help them. And the other thing, of course, you'd do on the political side is you would be committing political suicide, both for your reelection chances and for your party, which would have lost control of the Senate, lost further in the House, and lost state elections all over the place that would have led to even greater gerrymandering and even greater Democratic Party losses in the future. So this was, on every possible dimension, a terrible, terrible plan. It was terrible economically. It was a betrayal of everything the Democratic Party had stood for, and it was both personally and party-wise suicidal. And the irony, of course, is that Obama was saved not by anything he did, but by the Tea Party, which eventually put enough pressure on Boehner that he wouldn't agree to even the most minimal closing of tax loopholes on the rich. And so the deal died. But let's go back in time. This is July 2011. Unemployment was still at 9.1%. Within a few months of adopting this kind of austerity regime, we, like Europe, would have been thrown back into the recession. Unemployment would have shot well above 10%. And all through 2012, as you were running up to the election, on every month, unemployment would have been going up. There would have been no chance, whatever President Obama's ground game was, however bad a candidate the Republicans put up, he would have simply been toast. Obama would have been toast.
So, William K. Black, again, former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loans disaster of the 1980s, and currently professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Presumably, President Obama understands this, surely. And equally true, I imagine, is that the Republicans remember the deal that was on the table. So in this grand bargain that they're meeting over, they probably will insist that, that's still on the table. And I don't understand why this whole thing is called a fiscal cliff, what the urgency is here. Why not wait till January when the Bush tax cuts expire?
Well, there is no fiscal cliff. That's a deliberately provocative phraseology designed to create phony pressure to move. What will happen is some of the tax reductions by Bush will expire. And over the course of the year, there'll be higher taxation. But everybody knows that they're going to agree to reduce taxes, at least for the great bulk of Americans, and they will make it retroactive to the beginning of the year. So that's not going to have much effect. There will be cuts in spending, but the cuts in spending that they're about to agree to will probably be bigger on the domestic side than the fiscal, so-called fiscal cliff would do. So that's not the real issue either. I would be less confident than what you've expressed that Obama understands this. He has, the last time around, he was listening to the advice of this group called the Third Way that had provided him with his chief of staff. Third Way is this front group that pretends to be a moderate to liberal democratic think tank and is really completely dominated and was set up by Wall Street to represent the interests of Wall Street. And what I haven't explained to this point is why Wall Street is so interested in the great betrayal of the safety net. And the answer is Social Security. What Third Way openly wants, what Pete Peterson, the Republican billionaire who is behind these efforts, who came from Wall Street and has said he will spend $1 billion of his own money, so this is another one of these Adelson types screwing up America with their vast wealth, or at least trying to screw up America, is they want to privatize Social Security. Now, it won't happen all at once. It'll happen in stages. But just as only a conservative Republican president like Nixon could go to China because of the politics, only a Democratic president can open up the and begin the betrayal of the safety net programs. Because right now, for the Republicans to touch them on the national level is to touch the third rail, you know, instant death through electrocution. So Obama is going to open that door, and once he does and accept the Republican arguments, which, by the way, are completely false, that we have no choice, that we must destroy the safety net, that the safety net is the ruination of America, all this nonsense. Once he accepts those arguments and starts the process, then whenever the Republicans get the majority again, they'll have the political opening they've long wanted. And if you privatize Social Security, of course, what you do is produce trillions of dollars that Wall Street will now be able to get the fees on for investing them in these private retirement accounts. And that is going to mean hundreds of billions of dollars in additional wealth to Wall Street, which is, of course, already obscenely too economically and politically powerful. So this is a horrific idea, and the idea, of course, of austerity is so self-destructive, and we've just run an experiment. Europe did that. Look at Europe. Europe has unemployment rates, the Eurozone, half again as large as the United States. So we're, you know, right around 8, they're over 12 percent. It's an insane policy, but that's precisely the policy that President Obama's primary financial advisor has been pushing. And that, of course, is Timothy Geithner, who is not an economist, not a regulator, a failed regulator, somebody who didn't pay his taxes. By the way, didn't pay his Social Security payroll taxes. So, irony of irony, and he runs the IRS now. And has been quoted, and without, you know, has never denied it, that he said that stimulus is worthless and that it's, quote, like sugar or candy. And was then told by the president's top economist, you're insane, it's not like that at all. In fact, it's more like taking medicine, an immune shot to get over a terrible health crisis and such. But the president ignored his principal economic advisors and relied instead on Geithner and relied on this senior person from Third Way, who was a J.P. Morgan guy, and was his chief of staff, Mr. Daley, at the time. So there's actually no sign that President Obama understands that he tried to, with his so-called grand bargain, do terrible damage to the American economy, inflict enormous suffering on the American people, and betray the crown jewel of the Democratic Party, which is the safety net programs and all the promises the Democratic Party has made to protect that program and the Americans, and that's essentially all Americans, at some point in their lives, take advantage of the safety net. We're supposed to betray the party's promise to protect it.
So, William K. Black, clearly Pete Peterson's billion-dollar sales job on the sky is falling because of this deficit that they keep drumming up as the looming catastrophe. And as you pointed out, they managed to tie this notion of fiscal cliff into that sky is falling idea, which feeds into the idea that we have an impending crisis. There is no crisis with Social Security. Who's going to push back and point out that the emperor has no clothes in this argument? Social Security is in, it, first of all, it's not an entitlement. It's something that people pay for. It's something that they own. It's a public trust, and it is solvent. And furthermore, to make it even more solvent into the future, all you have to do is add a little extra fees on the wealthy who don't need Social Security as much as regular people do and yet benefit from it. So who's pushing back and saying, wait a minute, why are we going after something? In other words, it's an old expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, yeah, and it's even worse here, right? So first, why does the fiscal cliff exist? And the answer to that is because Obama and Boehner deliberately created it. When they failed to get their grand bargain, the Great Betrayal, they instead deliberately created a trigger to create austerity. No, and here, you know, they created so much austerity that even they knew that if you did nothing, it would throw the economy back in recession. Now, that is grotesquely irresponsible, right? But it's worse than that. So what they're telling us, listen to this logic. Because the fiscal cliff, which is, again is austerity, would throw the nation into recession, cause mass unemployment, and actually increase the deficit as opposed to decreasing it, we must avoid that austerity. And the way we must avoid that austerity is to adopt austerity. Through the grand bargain or great betrayal, which is even greater austerity. So this stuff is so incoherent that to even use the word coherent in the sentence as part of incoherent is misleading. This is literally nuts. And you have nobody in the mainstream, and that was what I was writing, listening to 6 hours of MSNBC, which, you know, has long supported stimulus, has long supported the safety net programs. They just treated it as obvious that there was only one answer, that this grand bargain was the greatest thing ever. We should all sing Kumbaya and do our bipartisan dance, and anything that was bipartisan must be good, even if it was a bipartisan suicide pact that betrayed the people most in need in America. So it's nuts on every dimension. Who's fighting it? Well, of course, people like us are fighting it, but the particularly good news is the AFL-CIO and other unions are very active in fighting it as well. And what this election made clear is, you know, that ground game and that get out the vote and all that good stuff, that was many people, but that was overwhelmingly union workers and progressives. That is the reason, along with the irony that the Tea Party saved Obama from the July 2011 deal, as I explained, were the reasons why Obama was reelected. And so it's time for people to remind President Obama about that. Here's the great danger. In addition to the kumbaya stuff about being bipartisan, all presidents, when they get in their second term, start thinking instantly in terms of legacy. What's going to leave my, you know, my mark on history? And Obama, this is very clear from what his own people said in the July 2011 negotiations. They see this grand bargain as his place in history. They know that, you know, the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, was really an embarrassment. Obviously, the president didn't warrant that kind of prize, and especially so early in his term. They all know he hadn't accomplished that. So when they look for the lasting accomplishment, they phrase this as courageous, right? That he's willing to turn on his base and betray them, that he's willing to betray the weakest people in need, most in need, the poorest Americans. That's being pictured by White House spin experts as courage. And of course, it is precisely the opposite. That kind of callous betrayal is the most cowardly of acts, and people need to call him on it. This is stuff that can't pass the simplest test of logic, as I've been explaining. So it really has to be fought, and fought hard. I explain in one of my pieces how Chris Matthews actually said that it was imperative that we not listen to Paul Krugman's arguments that this was a terrible deal and that there was no dastardly fiscal cliff that compelled action now. And he said, the president has to say, I'm the president, you're a columnist. Now, mind you, we're talking about economics. In fact, we're talking about macroeconomics, in which Paul Krugman won a Nobel Prize on the merits because of his expertise, and a guy that has had, generally speaking, quite a strong record of success predictively about all these aspects of the crisis. And Chris Matthews, MSNBC, the greatest sycophants, you know, for Obama, don't bother to explain any reason why we should engage, you know, enter into the great betrayal. They just say, you must not read the opposition. You must not listen to economists about the economy. So, you know, let's try that same idea. You know, let's say we were going to the moon and a Nobel Prize winning physicist said, you know, your plan to get to the moon relies on really bad physics and it's going to fail. And you know, let's say that the Nobel physicist wrote that in a column. Chris Matthews wants the president to stand up and said, you're a columnist, I'm a president. We're going to go to the moon my way.
Well, William K. Black, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s and currently is professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into how much the president has drunk the deficit Kool-Aid.